Senate Judiciary Budget Division Committee will come to order. Today is Thursday, February 22nd, the year 2007. And we're in room 125 in the state capitol. We're going to start out today with Supreme Court to finish up their budget preparation from the previous hearing. Senator, Mr. Snell, are you prepared to lead us on this?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the division. My name is Sue Dosal. I'm the state court administrator, and we're here to finish up just three final requests that are carry over from our last presentation. The first of these...
Mr. Dosal, the record will show that we have a quorum. Thank you. You may proceed.
Chair and members, the first of these requests is for funding for a virtual self-help center. This is to provide basic court information to citizens statewide. And what we would be requesting is funding that would use a very well-established Hennepin County self-help center as the hub. And then we would make self-help services available statewide over the web with a public PC computer in each of our counties, and then with a self-help line back to a call center in Hennepin County for human assistance. Now, why do we need self-help services? Well, we know that less than 20% of the legal needs of poor people can be met by legal services. We also know that that it's not just poor people, but moderate-income people that need these services as well. Many working folks cannot afford
their fee schedules.
Well, right, they can't afford lawyers, and sometimes and oftentimes they have a case that it just doesn't make financial sense to hire a lawyer. We see self-represented litigants in very high numbers in housing court. We see them in family court, even families involving family divorces involving children. We also see that people need court orders in a variety of circumstances, that they may be asked that need a court order in cases where, they're asked for it by the police, by child protection, by the child support office, by banks, schools, and it goes on and on. These are our grandmothers who are caring for a grandchild, and they need a custody order to enroll the child in school or to get medical help. This is someone who may have lost a job and needed a change in a child support order. Someone who sold a car, and the buyer has not registered the title transfer, and now they're getting tickets. Their parking tickets are coming to them, correcting birth certificates. It goes on and on and on. Now, well, they need self-help services because the law and case processes are complex, and, of course, they're very difficult to navigate for non-lawyers, even for lawyers in areas that they are not familiar with, frankly. But we know that the need is great. Here's an example in Hennepin County. They have a self-help center that last year served 33,000 people, and I think it's been in existence 5 years, maybe 5 years, and every year thousands more are coming in to seek these services. So the goal for the self-help center would be to improve access to courts statewide, to prepare litigants for hearings, and as a result, to reduce dismissals and continuances because these self-represented people come in and they're not prepared. And this is not only a source of frustration for them, but it is a source of frustration for the other parties who may be represented as well, and for the judges. So overall, we want to improve the quality of the information that's given to judges in these proceedings, and the ultimate result is to ensure that we have fair outcomes. Now, these are the services that would be involved: general information on all types of cases and proceedings, forms and instructions, video how-to tutorials in various kinds of proceedings, and we would hope that these would also be in a number of languages. We would have links to related laws and rules, and of course an important part of this would be call center assistance, so human assistance when forums and the web are not enough. Now, this is the basis of our request for the biennium with what we feel is a relatively modest investment in a PC in every court throughout the state, and with staff, two positions in the first year and two more in the second year, to provide this call center assistance. We believe that we can very significantly enhance access to justice for our citizens throughout the state. So this is the basis of this request.
What kind of staffing are you looking at as far as legal guardians?
Yes, and we would be talking about one lawyer and one support staff, a non-lawyer, but a person that would be trained in all of these areas in the first year and a similar complement in the second year.
Questions?
The second and last of the strategic initiatives that we are asking for is the development of a data quality assurance program in support of the judicial branch performance measures and monitoring requests. As one of the six overarching core judicial branch performance measures, the Judicial Council last July adopted a goal that the judicial branch will ensure the integrity and accountability of its performance by maintaining a record system that is accurate, complete, and timely. Now, valid assessment of court performance and the integrity of our court record all depend upon the accuracy, the timeliness, and completeness of data. And this is the data that's collected on these 2 million cases that we've talked about, filing throughout the whole process to disposition, as well as the $191 million in revenue that we collect. Now, last spring, we brought in a consultant to do an assessment of our data quality, and this consultant found that there are significant and systemic data quality problems that are due in large measure to differences in business practices from county to county, differences in data definitions, and data entry errors that are made by our several thousand employees working in 100 locations around the state, complicated by receiving data and sending data from and to different computer systems. And all of that really compromises the integrity of our official court record and the reliability of underlying operational and evaluation reports. Now, why do we care about data quality? Well, MNSIS, as you know, is the new statewide case management and court record system. It is now the official electronic record, which sends in real time to our Justice partners, not just statewide, but throughout the nation in many instances, information that affects the lives and liberty, in some cases, of people. So for that reason alone, records need to be accurate, timely, and complete. But we also use this underlying data for a variety of internal branch uses as well, for managing and monitoring individual cases and the caseload as a whole, and certainly for policy evaluation that we do internally and that we provide support for in terms of legislative evaluation. So in today's world of instant communication with data harvesters and public safety and privacy issues, data quality assurance is absolutely essential. So this is the reason that we are asking for funding to develop a state-level data quality assurance program, which would include funding for staff and for data management tools and training. In addition, it would include funding for ongoing case-by-case data entry error identification and corrections that we would do in the 87 counties throughout the state. This is a very essential part of this new world that we're living in, and we certainly urge your support.
Can you kind of bring us through a little bit to show how the system works in order to make sure that everyone here on the committee has...
Just to give you some idea of the complexity of the data that we're dealing with, I just heard last week that if you took all of the characters from the name, address, and telephone number for every single city and town in the country that's in the white pages, that would be 5 billion characters. And what we're talking about in our system is over 300 billion characters. So that just gives you some idea of the issues that are involved in terms of data and the potential for data errors. The other issue really is, until recently, as you know, we've been county-funded primarily with 87 different counties and in many ways 87 different entities. And as a result, the business practices vary from place to place. Some of the business practices are certainly different in Hennepin County than they would be in Coochiching County. But some of these data practices impact on the data and the meaning of the data. The other part of it I think that is important to know is that it's not just the complexity of the computer systems, but it is the complexity of the underlying substantive and procedural law data information that the data represents. I mean, what's in all of these statute books is very difficult to appropriately and consistently maintain in a large computer system like this. The sentencing dispositions data is very complex. Child protection, that whole area is very complex about when people are out of home and when they come back and the like. So all of this requires a significant amount of training. It requires coming to a agreement within the judicial branch about certain disposition codes that you're going to use. And all of that is a very complex issue. And so any large organization that is as complex as ours, as complex as the computer system that we have, whether it's a private sector or public sector, would have a very significant, robust data quality assurance program, and that's what we're talking about here. You know, you hear about data quality in the private sector. We need that very much in the public sector to assure that the data that's affecting the lives and liberty of people is accurate, timely, and complete. I think you, Mr. Chairman, know a little bit about that from the issues of CRIMNET and the suspense file at the BCA. These are similar kinds of issues that relate in the judicial branch.
When you look at your system and how it's integrated and other things, can you explain for the people that are here just exactly how that those track, who's responsible for your data security and what kinds of programs you have, and then in addition to that, how that fits in with the corrections and the other?
Well, MNSIS is the court information system, so we take information at the time of the filing of a case until its disposition. But throughout this process, information that we have, actually the court information, as I understand it, is really sort of the hub of the whole criminal justice information system. It is about 50% of all of the data interactions come into or go out of the court. So it really is very much the hub. MNSIS is our new court information system. It is it's new technology, so we're capable of data integration with a variety of our justice partners, with our justice partners, and actually, with the public as well. So we are in charge of maintaining that system and have an IT division in my office that does this. We are working, and as part of our vision is to provide electronic integration, so e-filing, essentially both in the criminal area first and in the civil area ultimately, which will be very helpful in reduction of data errors because we'll get it directly from the police or from the prosecutor. And then we now are sending out and do and have for many years, but also through Mensis, court disposition information that would go directly to BCA and updating the criminal history system. And, of course, BCA sends it out also to NCIC, the National Criminal History System, where that's appropriate.
In the process that you're dealing with, for instance, in CrimNet and the what is the role of the court system in getting making sure the system
has some kind of difference? I believe that we have in Mensis has not yet been taken. So that, as you know, most people that come into the court are not in a criminal proceeding, are not booked and arrested. Most of them come into a staff charge, so they're given a citation and told to appear at a certain time in the future. So those people who come in, there is no fingerprint on those individuals. And so we have a statutory requirement that in targeted misdemeanor areas, the more serious misdemeanor areas, in addition to others, that they need to be fingerprinted and be put into the criminal history system. And so our part of that is to make sure that as they come in and appear, that if they haven't been fingerprinted, that that's, that is known to the people in the court system and at that particular proceeding. And then it would be the responsibility of law enforcement to make sure that they are fingerprinted before that process ends or after it ends.
Thank you. Members, questions?
The last of our requests relates to security in the Minnesota Judicial Center. It is woefully lacking at the current time. Our building houses the staff and judges of the highest courts, the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals, the Tax Court, Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals, State Court Administration, and Law Library. We have, you know, thousands of visitors that come in every year, visiting the courtrooms, the law library, and meetings throughout. We have currently one unarmed capital security person to manage and monitor multiple entrances to this building and five courtrooms, many of them that are going on at the same time. And that's impossible for one person to do. Recently, the National Guard Reserve did an assessment of the security situation in the entire Capitol and our building as well, and recommended that we have a weapon screening equipment as well as the necessary staff to man that. That would include one armed trooper and two unarmed Capitol security guards. So this is a request that would fund that recommendation of the National Guard Reserve.
When you said that, I think you misstated. My hearing is the trooper would be armed and the capital security would be unarmed.
Yes, I'm sorry. One armed, the other is unarmed. You're correct.
And
thank you.
Looking at that, what do you expect to accomplish in security with those kinds of dollars?
Well, it would provide for a weapon screening process in the Minnesota Judicial Center. And we have these two major entrance areas, the tunnel that flows through it, as well as the 25 Constitution Avenue. So it would assure people in our building that those that come through them will not have weapons. And that's a significant concern. I think as we've talked before that what the courts do oftentimes affect the lives, the liberty, families of people. They are very emotionally charged situations, and we know about shootings, we know about bombings in the trial courts. One thing I would say is that oftentimes that's not the final stop for individuals at the trial court. They are pursuing appeals. They are having significant concerns. Some of my staff deal in the guardian ad litem area, in child protection and family area. They have threats of staff. This is not just judges who have concerns, and there are threats against judges as well, but also the staff. We have pictures of people that have made threatening phone calls that are sent around our building, but there is no screening whatsoever. And so this would assure our staff and our judges that at least that weapons screening is likely to be effective.
When you're talking about security, there are a lot of factors that enter into that. And I know the state did do a survey back a few years and came out with some recommendations. And there's a variety of things, and there's a variety of opinions as to the dangers that people in this building and as well as yours. On the other hand, I suspect that the amount of incidents where there's been any kind of assault or crimes, if you will, is relatively small, and I can't recall the last time I saw any or any indication of any person crimes, for instance. And what's disturbing in the court process is that we have kind of lost out the ability to meet and discuss things with the judges in our district and other people, and I want you to be safe, but I really hurt that I can't continue to see Judge Lynch, for instance. That he's behind locked doors and comes out on the bench, and there's a bailiff or a deputy in the courtroom, perhaps, and the average citizen only sees the judge for a very short period of time. And while I'm not saying we shouldn't have security, I just want to make sure we don't move too cautiously and, in effect, deny that. You can walk in my office, and you have, I don't have any protection, nor do I want any. I want the people to come to see me, and I'm more than willing to take them. So I throw that out for general comment as to what's going on in the system.
Well, Mr. Chair, certainly that has always been the balancing between these are public officials, public employees. You want this to be open to the public. Against the potential threats that in the modern society that we live in. And people often say you have to wait until some tragedy happens before this will occur, and we have had those. We know we've been in the situation here in Minnesota. And so we are bringing it to your attention because our judges and our staff feel that this is a significant concern. And say the National Guard Reserve did this this capital-wide assessment of security, and it was based on their recommendations. They think that we are significantly underprotected in terms of something that could be done to protect some future tragedy. So, you know, we leave this in your good hands to make a decision. I would just tell you that we have been asked, our judges for many years have been concerned about the lack of protection, unlike in a trial court where there are bailiffs that are provided for trial judges. In most instances, we have nothing. And we are concerned about what might happen and are making this request, hopefully before a tragedy does happen.
Well, I agree with that, and I certainly don't want you to get the feeling that I want somebody to come in here and do that. The issue that you bring is a different one for Judge Lynch, because the state is not funding the buildings and the other parts of the what would be security. They probably aren't funding the sheriff's deputies that are in the courtroom either, and so you have a much different security system in the trial bench than you have here. And,
Mr. Chair, and that's exactly right. The county funds security for the trial courts. The only state-funded operation in the courts is the Minnesota Judicial Center. We don't have a county to go to, so we have the legislature, and we're making this request as a result.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's my question. In the Sheriff's Department, it is the sheriff's statutory responsibility to secure the courts. I'm understanding here, then, that it would be the legislature's responsibility to secure this particular. If I might just make one comment, and then I have to step out. I would not like to see us wait until that does happen. I did have an incident where a dear friend of mine actually was murdered because we had no security in our courtroom, and actually the perpetrator came before the judge with four guns on him, unbeknownst to the bailiffs. That's some time ago, but nevertheless, it does happen, and especially when you have a real open-door policy like that, that can happen. So I really appreciate your concerns and your report here, Sue, with regards to this, because, you know, it's so typical we do wait to respond to something like this. I was over there to a meeting. I was quite surprised there wasn't any security there. All county courts, I think, are secured pretty well right now, I think, statewide. So you will have to walk through a metal detector. And it is intrusive. It really is. I understand where you're coming from, Senator. When we had to lock up our doors in the dispatch so that they can't come in personally and make that personal contact with the dispatch. But unfortunately, that's the world we're in right now. So just a comment. Thank you.
Senator Hayes.
Mr. Chair, you and I both work for local government and our other jobs, and I know I work behind a locked door, and 15 years ago before I came to this job, I worked for local government and worked behind a locked door, and it's the world we live in, and there are just too many situations that make not only the elected officials but their staff really uncomfortable with people's behavior. And you know, we need to protect not only the elected officials, the staff as well, and we need to make sure that we get some security in place before something does happen.
I can sense that I stepped on something that has no real solution for me. I want you to know that I do support your security. I want to throw these things out to deal with those, because I know what it is. I'm in the Anoka County Courthouse. The social workers that deal with various money programs and so forth, they're exposed to a lot of things, and they're behind locked doors, but all of the county attorney staff there's no security there at all, and the current county attorney doesn't want any in there, and that's pretty much the way that goes. So it's something. I know there's a change. The day that I could walk into the Freeborn County courtroom and sit down and talk to the judge there is long gone. First place, the judges now are much busier and don't have time to do that. But on the other side of the coin is that it's more dangerous to go. Although most of the problems with security in the district level seems to me has occurred outside when they were in their home or something, like the incident up in Blooming Prairie and so forth.
So the most recent, of course, was right in Hennepin County, and the people that got shot were not judges, but family lawyer, and that's why we're
further discussion. And I take it that Judge Lynch
wrap up then of our overall request, and I'd ask Judge Lynch to step in now.
Mr. Chair and members, as you can see in summary, the court's...
State your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Ed Lynch. I'm a judge in the 1st Judicial District. I'm chambered in Dakota County.
Thank you.
As you can see from the slide, in summary, the court's portion of the judicial branch budget request is $66.35 million. And the governor has included in his budget only $34.2 million for the courts. The governor's recommendation is $13 million short of what is needed just to fund the inflationary costs for our employees and the growth in our legally mandated services. The judicial branch receives only the funding recommended by the governor. I fear a dramatic negative impact on our ability to provide the level and quality of service the people of this state need and deserve. If we cannot keep up with the demand for mandated services, the interpreters, guardian ad litems, and psychological evaluations, cases will be delayed, cases will be compromised. If we lose staff because layoffs are necessary in order to pay increased costs of insurance and increased costs of collectively bargained contracts, our ability to process the millions of cases filed each year will be undermined, and I'm afraid that the remaining hardworking, dedicated employees we have will be seeking less stressful, less demanding employment elsewhere. We recognize that there are many worthy causes competing for very limited resources. So eventually, the question becomes, why should you care about the courts? The usual answer is that the courts deserve support because we are the third branch of government, we have constitutional responsibilities, and we provide a core government function. These, of course, are the most important reasons. But in addition to the traditional response, I believe the courts deserve support because we're doing a good job. We are efficient, effective, well-managed, responsible, and accountable. I realize that the judicial branch does not have a natural constituency. Most people don't even want to think about using the services of the court because that means that some aspect of their life is in turmoil. So we can't pack the corridors of the Capitol with supporters. We can't even pack this room with supporters. We can't flood you with emails, phone calls, and visits by concerned citizens urging that you give favorable consideration to the judicial branch budget request. But that does not mean that we are not without significant widespread support. Minnesota courts enjoy a national reputation for excellence and innovation. The National Chamber of Commerce consistently ranks Minnesota courts in the top 10 in the nation for fair, timely, impartial service. A recent public opinion poll found that 80% of the respondents, 80%, expressed confidence in the courts in Minnesota. That translates into the equivalent of over 4 million Minnesotans telling us, and by extension telling you, that the courts in Minnesota are doing a good job and deserve support. As you know, the transition of state funding of the courts was completed in 2005. That represented the legislative branch's commitment to adequately fund the state courts and the judicial branch's commitment to be accountable and responsible for the tax dollars you provide. To date, both branches have honored these commitments. The court system is for the first time able to combine budget and policy-making authority in a central governance structure. This has provided us the ability to streamline and consolidate operations, the flexibility to reallocate and redistribute resources, and the opportunity to fund the priorities of our strategic plan. Because of your commitment to state funding, the judiciary has transformed itself into a responsive, accountable organization that can allocate resources based upon need, not relationships, develop and promote best practices, establish and enforce performance goals, and deliver services more efficiently, effectively, and equitably. The courts have also taken on the leadership role in collaborative efforts with other participants in the justice system to implement innovative approaches that go beyond just resolving disputes that are before the court and to address the underlying problems that bring people to the court in the first place. The drug courts that you heard about last week are examples of this successful effort. Behind the numbers and the statistics of this budget request are people. This is not about judges or even about the judicial branch. This budget request is about the battered woman seeking help, the estranged couple having to rearrange their lives and families, individuals and businesses wanting resolutions to disputes and certainty for their future, abused and neglected children and vulnerable adults needing protection and the timely processing of criminal cases to ensure public safety. This budget request is about the fundamental right of the people of this state to obtain justice. The judicial branch has been a responsible steward of the resources you have provided. It is providing constitutionally mandated services not available elsewhere, and it has an objectively documented need. Without the ongoing support of the legislature, we will not be able to continue to discharge our constitutional responsibilities. I can tell you that despite our best efforts and our increased efficiency, we are struggling throughout the state to maintain timely calendars and to provide timely service. And I think the testimony of Judge Tenick and Judge Knutson last week demonstrated that and the concerns that result from that. If funding is provided only at the level recommended by the governor, cuts and delays in services are inevitable. And unfortunately, as Chisago County Commissioner Lynn Schultz testified, preventative programs and efforts are usually the first casualties. I hope that the Stearns County Drug Court that saved Barb Klein's life and the court clerk that spent hours helping a man prove that he was a citizen are not the unintended victims of inadequate funding. Whether your ultimate funding decision is based upon the importance of the service provided to the people of the state, demonstrated need, or proven performance, the judicial branch is worthy of your support. When you establish your funding priorities, the administration of justice should be at the top of your list, because there is no more important function of government, and there is no greater benefit you can provide the people of this state. So let me conclude by saying, on behalf of a growing number of people who need the services of the court and who are directly affected by this funding request, muchas gracias.
Many members, you've heard the presentations. Do you have any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Chairman, Judge, and I don't know if you expected to put this out. With the 9 additional trial court judges that have gone through the districts, that was obviously based on what, the caseload study? Was this at the, where does that bring you in terms of judgeships? Was that kind of the top 91%, or would there arguably be another 20 in a perfect world?
Well, the nine, Mr. Chairman and Senator Cohen, the 9 new judgeships that we are requesting was based on the weighted caseload as applied to filings that were at the end, the year end of 2005. That was the most current calendar year that we had before we were required to submit our budget. If you did that today, the number would be 14. Presumably, if we had done projections into this next biennium, it would be more than that. So, but we are requesting 9. That's what we put in, and that's what we're requesting. Although we right as of today, need 14 in order to maintain a caseload that's 49% greater than comparable states, the caseloads that judges are carrying for comparable states around the country. That's just to keep at that level.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Salazar, was there any surprise when you took a look at the 2005 figures in terms of, for instance, Judge Lynch, your district has been, over the last number of years, probably the biggest growth district?
Could you speak up a little bit, Senator Cohen?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I said that Judge Lynch's district has been historically, over the last number of years, one of the biggest growth districts, along with the 10th. But were there any surprises in some of the greater Minnesota districts?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Cohen, you know, it's not a surprise to us because we're beginning to – we have for a number of years seen this growth begin. And the regional economic centers now in the 9th district – Crow Wing County, of course, is a booming area, and Bemidji and Grand Rapids. We're seeing that in the 7th District as well. Of course, there's enormous growth in St. Cloud and in that area that's happening. So those two districts. And we also have now seen some resurgence in both the 3rd District, which has been even for many, many years, an uptake there, and even in the 5th District, which is, is the central part of Minnesota. So I think that that is, those two perhaps are new on our list now, but the other districts, we have seen this growth and have been part of our request in the past.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dozel, the governor recommends giving you half of what your request was. So if that's all we can come up with for you, does that mean you'll add 4 or 5 new judges instead of the 9 that you requested, as opposed to the 14 that you know you have now?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I think our biggest concern is that that we're being a lot more difficult situation than just new judgeships. I mean, we would be talking about holding open positions, even perhaps laying off staff, and or not having funding for these constitutional or statutory requirements that we have for interpreters, for guardians ad litem, for doing these psychological examinations in the sexual predator area. I mean, this would be an enormous problem. And to the extent that we would get new judgeships, that would be made even worse if that were the case. And I think that's the point that we're making, is that this request is woefully inadequate for just what we need to keep our heads above water, let alone any funding for judgeships, for these strategic initiatives, drug courts, these things that are really innovative and are making a real difference, investing in people up front so that we can save costs for both jail costs to the counties, out-of-home placement costs for child protection, prison bed space, and the like.
Mr. Thill, but in reality, the issue that you talked about increasing the number of judges, but the fact is that you then got to look at all of the support services, the court reporters and the guardian ad litem and public defenders and all of that. And so we're really talking a much bigger package than what it is if you just take the judges into consideration.
Mr. Chair, I think that in terms of the courts, those things that you're talking about are taken into account in our request. The public defender piece would be part of their request. You're right.
The other thing we had... two of your fine judges, Knutson and Teneich, who indicated extremely high caseloads and so forth. How does that compare with other district judges? Are we looking at the same level of demand?
I think the concern is, Mr. Chair, I think the concern is statewide. Most of the judges I visit with at conferences complain of the high numbers of cases that Judge Teneich testified to. Also, the current concern that you're not able to give adequate time to the cases that you do hear because of the pressure of more cases that are waiting to be heard that Judge Knutson testified to. To give you an example, between 2004 and 2006, the number of jury trials in Dakota County in felony and gross misdemeanor cases rose by 45%. And those are the types of things that really take a lot of time for a judge. If you're taking that much more time for those jury trials, you're going to have less time for the people that come in on the more routine cases. And so that's the problem that we all face, and I think it's statewide, and I think it's becoming more and more difficult as the cases become more and more complex, the penalties and consequences become more significant. It's much more of a problem to maintain the type of quality and level of services for these people that they deserve.
Thank you. Committee members, questions, comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. I'd like to move to the Civil Legal Services and Mr. Beneke, are you or Mr. Lane?
medically today.
All right. You're the heavy hitter here.
I'm heavy. I don't know about the hitting. I'll stand until the chair is available, but I hold your time as
well. Oh, just pull another chair.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity to appear in front of you today. My name is Bruce Beneke, and I'm the director of Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services and here representing the seven legal aides today, which comprise the Minnesota Legal Services Coalition. And together we provide legal services in all 87 of Minnesota's counties on critical civil matters. We help about nearly 100,000 people a year on the 35 to 40,000 cases we take. We also assist about another 25,000 a year on the preventative law and community education work that we do. On behalf of the coalition, I'm very grateful for the long-standing bipartisan support of the Senate and the House for legal services. We're also very grateful to the Minnesota Supreme Court for having included us in their budget since 1982 and including us in their budget request. And in fact, the justice partnership in Minnesota between the legislature, the courts, the Minnesota State Bar Association, legal aides, is nationally recognized as perhaps the best in the country. So I'm very, very grateful to all of you for your past support and appreciate the opportunity to talk about our budget request a little bit today. Before doing that, I'm not going to repeat Mr. Lane's overview to you. I know you've got other important things to talk about, but I would like to talk very briefly before the budget request about the work of legal aid. I was once again moved by Judge Lynch's remarks, and really the work of legal aid is also about the battered women, the vulnerable people, the estranged couples, and the children he talked about, and the work of legal aid very much is part of our work together to provide Minnesotans with equal justice before the law. And in doing this, I'd like to share three brief examples which I think give you a good idea of what we do, not only in terms of helping individual people, but also in benefiting the broader community and the courts. The first example is in the battered women, battered children category. During this past year or year and a half, we had an occasion in our office where one of our clients came in. She and her family came in to honor our staff attorney for his work. It turned out that this particular woman had been beaten several times, had been thrown from a moving automobile. Her children had been both physically and sexually abused, and the man in question was a very wealthy person who was able to go through the court procedures and drag things out. Our lawyer represented this family in a multitude of hearings and things over the years, and the family came in and it just stunned me. It was during the state wrestling tournament. The two boys had grown up to be able to be in the state wrestling tournament. And she presented a legal aid lawyer with this plaque, and I think it really sums up the work that legal aid does. And she said in the plaque, "You helped me turn an awful family situation into two talented, very strong, healthy boys that will make a difference in the world. You helped me to keep my head above water. You helped me, you did this by being there, counseling me, believing me in me, loving and caring for me. You deserve more than I can ever give, and I know that God has something also for you planned. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for my life and the lives of my children." Now, that's one case, but it is a good indication of the powerful difference that legal aid services can make in families' lives. And not only that, but benefiting the broader community. I know that that you've always done great work here on domestic abuse issues, and much of legal aid's work is aimed at preventing domestic abuse and solving family complex family problems, as that situation indicates. And in fact, the Department of Justice study a couple of years ago examined the national data and concluded that the only variable for sure of all the different things available that could predictably reduce the incidence of domestic violence was the availability of a legal aid lawyer. And nationally, domestic abuse costs about $4.1 billion, and every domestic case that we're able to take and prevent further abuse, we contribute to saving taxpayer money. So that's one illustration. A second one is a very recent one. I know that some of you are very interested in this issue, and that's the terrible problem that we face increasingly in our community with mortgage foreclosures and predatory lending. And again, one case, but it illustrates the work we do. We represented an elderly person who was frail, had lost his wife, and became so depressed in the context of that that he got behind on his house payments and the family homestead. He was also trying to raise their adult disabled son. When he got behind, a pernicious lender came in, promised him the moon about saving the house if he'd only do this and that. And lo and behold, about a year later, the balloon payment came due, and this elderly gentleman and his son were faced with the prospect of losing the family homestead and being out in the street. Legal Aid stepped into that case. Instead of filing a complex case, and some of you know how complicated predatory lending cases can be, we sought mediation, and to keep it out of the court, we were successfully able to reach a settlement that kept this elderly man, his disabled son, in the house for another year and a half, and to achieve sufficient equity out of the family homestead so that he could purchase a mobile home so that he and his son could live safely in the days to come. And again, this is an example of the difference legal aid work makes, not only for the individual, but in the way that we save the court's time by settling and mediating cases and by keeping cases out of the court system. And in fact, in the materials Mr. Lane gave you, we estimate that we save over $5 million a year in extra court costs by the work that legal aid does. The third example that I would like to give of the work of legal aid and its broader impact is in the area of helping seniors, immigrants, disabled people, and refugees and veterans. And that's the disability work that we did. Just this week, I was talking with one of our legal aid lawyers who helped repeatedly persons who are casualties of the Vietnam War. In this particular instance, this woman had lost both of her parents during the Vietnam War, had lived in the refugee camps, finally came over to the United States, had had 3 weeks of education when she came to the United States, was not able to speak English, worked for a number of years in menial factory jobs, finally was injured and lost her job, and turned to legal aid for help. We were able to represent her at the administrative law hearing, and in doing that, we're not only able to bring Social Security benefits to her so that she can survive, but by being able to get her eligible, we're able to make her eligible for health care so that she can have her health care needs. And more than that, this kind of work, which again is an example of a lot of work that we do, brings in over $5 million a year to the state of federal disability money that otherwise persons would have to be on general assistance and which would drain the general fund here in Minnesota. So these three examples are the kind of work that we do, and really, as I reflect back, it was really great to see Senator Ten Eyck last week, who was a legal aid attorney himself, and Senator Knutson, who, along with Senator Cohen and many of you, have helped legal aid so much out over the years. And I was struck by Senator Knutson's remarks about the job of the justice system being to provide fair treatment, impartial treatment, and to give people hope. And that really is the job of our entire justice system, and that's really the job of legal aid, is to provide the same kind of fair treatment, this kind of same effective access to our judicial system, and hope to people. In doing that work, again, I think it's important to emphasize, and I think Mr. Lane had some of this in the materials, but the Minnesota Supreme Court has consistently supported us. Chief Justice Blatz a couple of years ago indicated in writing how much court time legal aid saves through our steering non-meritorious cases away from the courts, settling and mediating matters, doing preventative law work and educating people to help themselves. And then finally, we have to be in court helping the system to work efficiently and effectively. We also help a lot with the pro se problem. I mean, we do keep people out of pro se situations by steering them away when they don't have cases. We also provide them a lot of self-help information, which Mr. Lane talked about. Our budget request, Mr. Chairman, in members is $2 million. Each year of the biennium, or $4 million total, as indicated in the court request. It's against the backdrop, as many of you will recall, of the 18% cut in legal aid funding that we suffered between 2001 and 2004, which caused the legal aid to reduce the number of lawyers full-time from 178 around the state of Minnesota down to 135 positions. That's to serve 439,000 Minnesotans whose incomes are low enough to be eligible for civil legal assistance. Thanks to your support last session and the support of others, we were able to realize an increase, and we were able to restore 30 of those lost positions, getting us back up now statewide to 165 legal aid lawyers to serve this population. At the same time, as Sue pointed out in her her display, the need for civil legal services, many persons go unserved. In fact, the Minnesota Supreme Court has had two commissions the past 10 years to study legal aid statewide and to make recommendations to how we can help more people. And they note that at least half the people who come to legal aid who are eligible are turned away because of limited resources. And as Sue noted, many other persons probably don't even come because we know that we can't, don't have the resources to help everyone. So it's against this backdrop of the 18% cut and restoring 30 positions, so we're back up to 165, but also recognizing that there's still a huge unmet need for legal aid and thus access to justice in Minnesota, that we respectfully request the $2 million increase. How the money will be spent, $850,000 to $900,000 of it will be spent in maintaining the positions we were able to restore. Like the court, we have increased interpreter costs, and we also have increased health costs. I know in my own program, I just got the news the other day, our health care costs will go up 22%. Next year, we also do the same kind of technology from case management to self-help that Mr. Sell testified about. And so $850,000 to $900,000 would help us to maintain where we're at in Minnesota in terms of providing access to justice to low-income persons. If you were able to grant us another $900,000, getting us up to $1,800,000, we would be able to restore 12 more attorney positions statewide. And between maintaining the new positions that you helped us to restore and these additional restoration positions, we'll be able to help at least on 2,500 cases a year, benefiting probably at least 10,000 persons a year. And we'll be able to help in all the areas mentioned above. We'll be able to prevent domestic abuse. We'll be able to help prevent homelessness. We'll be able to help repair substandard housing. We'll be able to assist in unemployment, Social Security matters, in immigration and citizenship matters. We will also be able to help persons access health care. We'll keep kids in school and help programs to respond to kids' needs in schools. We'll be able to assist seniors. We'll be able to assist farmers. And mostly we'll be able to help all of us together in the justice partnership to carry out the essential government service of providing equal justice under law. In conclusion, I didn't account for the other 200,000. The other 200,000 of the 2 million would be used to increase beginning legal aid salaries up to $40,000. Right now, beginning legal aid salaries are $38,500, which is at least $10,000 behind our counterparts in other kinds of sectors. This would allow us to get our starting salaries up to $40,000 to hopefully retain some of our best and brightest, those newer persons who understand technology. And then a couple of years from now, they'll be able to do presentations that I can't. We're very accountable in Minnesota. We're proud of it. We had a comprehensive statewide evaluation in 2005. We got very high marks from a group of national experts. Consider Minnesota in many ways to be the model legal aid justice partnership in the country, as mentioned. We also had two statewide commissions, as I indicated, in the past 10 years to help us get better. And we carry out, as mentioned, an essential government service. And in doing that, we save a lot of taxpayer money. And as mentioned, when I combined all those savings I mentioned earlier in all these different case areas, the $12,300,000 investment that you make in legal aid not only allows us to leverage $15 million in other funds, but allows us to save the taxpayers' conservative estimate at least $19 million a year. So we feel like legal aid is both the right thing to do because we help people who are in such hardship and such difficult situations, as all the judges have indicated to you in their own testimony. We certainly support the court budget fully, and we believe, as the Minnesota Supreme Court Commission found in its comprehensive report, which was given to the legislature in 2005, it says that legal aid benefits the broader community. Civil legal services stabilizes families, maintains communities, and makes society safer, saves taxpayer money, helps prevent legal problems, which would further clog the court system, and helps people to become self-sufficient and to participate effectively in society. I'm very, very grateful and respectful of your past support. We're a very, very good investment, and we'll use the money wisely and widely throughout the state, including in the health care and access to education areas. I look forward to working with you all in the time to come, and I'm happy to answer any questions or get additional information you might need in the weeks to come. Thank you.
Committee members, questions, comments?
Mr. Chair, I'll make a comment. You and I both represent Anoka County, and I used to be on the board of directors of Judicare, which is part of legal aid. What they do in that system is that they find lawyers in private practice, and then they have them take on these cases, and then they pay them an hourly rate. And I had to get off the board in the mid-'80s because I was also the chair of the Fridley Planning Commission. They met the same nights, and so I couldn't do both. But I remember going through a tough time, budget cut time period, where we had to raise, I think, the hourly rate from $30 an hour to $40 an hour, which is well below what these attorneys could make, you know, in their private practices, but that's what we afford to pay them. And then about a week or so ago, the director that we had hired, who's still there, you know, came by to see me, and I said, "What's the hourly rate now?" He said, $50 an hour. That's still well below. But that's what they pay. And the lawyers take these cases. They will accept that rate of payment. But, you know, virtually every one of these lawyers can charge, you know, three times that. And when you consider the hours that they spend on these cases, they're actually losing money, you know, to do them. So that's just, you know, one example of the area of the world that, you know, I live in, and you live in, Mr. Chair, that some of the lawyers that are making sacrifices, you know, to provide services. But, you know, there's a limit to how far they can go.
I know what you mean, Senator Bessel. I didn't get any money. So they may have only gotten the value out of it that they paid for, but that I do know that a number of private practice attorneys are involved in working with the legal aid services.
And actually, as I think about it, there's a requirement that, in addition, just by being on that panel, they have to take a certain number of pro bono cases.
Yep.
So not only are they paid far less, but they have to do some for free.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, Floyd Panuski is the director of Anoka County, and he's made me aware of both of your contributions, both as Judicare and as a volunteer attorney, Senator Foley. Also, I'm familiar with Senator Cohen's volunteer work here in Ramsey County. And there's a rich tradition of Minnesota lawyers trying to help legal aid also either through reduced fee work. I know my program is reduced fee contracts with 30 private law firms in rural southern Minnesota to help us on farm law cases. And we pay them $55 an hour, though the client pays $15 of it and legal aid pays $40 of it. My dad was a small town lawyer, and I'm very respectful and recognize the contributions that so many Minnesota lawyers make to help us serve more people in the system. But Senator Betzold is right. Even with all those very gracious donations of time, we're still far away from meeting the true unmet need for access to justice in critical civil matters. But I thank all of you senators who find time to do pro bono in one way or other.
Thank you very much. Members? Apparently not.
Printing press anywhere? Can we just start
printing money? Printing press? Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much.
I look forward to talking and working with you more.
We now reach Senate File 300. Senator Higgins.
Yeah, this is the printing press. This is the one that makes it legal.
I'm learning something new every day.
I think there has to be something that happens.
Mr. Kier, are you going to start this out or Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, all I would do is introduce Mr. Kier, so, you know.
Mr. Kier.
Mr. Chairman and members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kier. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. I believe you have an amendment.
I think we do have an amendment, don't we?
Could we have that passed off, please?
Is it something you can discuss while it's being passed off?
Sure. Mr. Chairman and members, some of you heard this bill in the Policy Committee. The amendment today would do two things. One would strike language relative to standby counsel or advisory counsel, which was a subject of some discussion at the Policy Committee. The other section, it's page 9, section 12, relative to the copayment, I believe. I'm on the right page. As we found out after that hearing or in the course of that hearing, there was language there that prohibited the court from imposing a copayment. Since that time, the Department of Finance has suggested to us that they are counting $780,000 in fees for the next biennium in 08-09 that would be generated by a copayment. I think that's what the fiscal note also addresses, if the fiscal note is there in front of you. So the amendment would delete that language and would allow the court, if they are imposing it, to continue to impose a copayment if, in fact, they are. So that's the amendment.
Senator Higgins, are you moving the A3 amendment?
Yes.
Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Contrary, nay. Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, and I guess I'll leave it to you, is being that it's the Finance Committee, if you want to deal with just the financial issues, we can certainly go through the entire bill if you like. In terms of financial issues with the amendment, there's no financial impact on the bill with the elimination of that copayment language. So
we really don't need any testimony in this committee. Okay, so the amendment is passed, and the ruling of Mr. has indicated that we can just go forward. I'm not sure where it would go.
Pastor, everything's got to go to the Finance Committee. Well, that's the only way I can get from the floor from the Budget Division. It's through the Finance Committee. So
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 300 be recommended to pass or go to Big Finance. You can't keep this stuff straight.
I did not ask, but I will before we move too far. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak to this legislation? Senate File 300 as amended. No takers? Apparently not. We have not voted on it, as I recall. So all those in favor indicate by aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, nay. Motion failed.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Complete our agenda.
So what are we going to do next?